So thank you for all coming to this second talk in the series of four on science and Krishna consciousness. You know, I have a little problem with my throat today, so you know, I can't speak as loud as I normally would. So please bear with me. Yesterday, we talked about Bhagavatam history and modern archaeology as it relates to the question of human origins. And in that presentation, I gave lots of evidence from scientific sources about human artifacts, human bones, human footprints that are many, many millions of years old. And of course, this contradicts the Darwinian theory of evolution. And it's consistent with the accounts of extreme human antiquity that we find in the Puranas, like the Bhagavat Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam. So today I'm also talking about archaeology, but it's kind of going beyond the kinds of things that I was talking about yesterday, which are reported in scientific journals. Today I'm going to be talking about other kinds of discoveries, and the dating of them comes from Shastra and tradition and the Vaishnav tradition, rather than scientific sources. So what I'm going to say today is based in part on a paper that I presented at a meeting of the European Association of South Asian Archaeologists. Those are the archaeologists who work in India and other South Asian countries. And this conference took place at the British Museum in London, and I presented a paper there, and I was drawing the attention of these archaeologists to a certain fact. That according to the standard histories of archaeology in India, archaeology in India supposedly began with the arrival of European travelers in India in the 17th century, such as Pietro della Valle, who came to India in the early 1600s and wrote a book about his experiences there that included some archaeological reports. And then the standard history of archaeology in India moves on to Sir William Jones, who founded the Royal Asiatic Society in 1784. And then it moves on to the early professional archaeologists who were working with the Archaeological Survey of India at a time when India was under the control of the British, basically. This is Alexander Cunningham, who was the first director of the Archaeological Survey of India. And then we move on to modern professional archaeology in India, which began post-independence, post-1948. So these archaeologists have come to certain conclusions. They've come to the conclusion that Vedic culture was not native to India. They believe it came from outside India, from the northwest, maybe about 3,500 years ago. So they don't accept the idea that there was any Vedic culture in India before that. For example, we say time and time again, Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita on the battlefield of Kurukshetra 5,000 years ago. According to the standard history of archaeology, well, they would say that's not true. They say there wasn't any Vedic culture in India 5,000 years ago. There was no Hastinapur, Dwarka, or any of those places. What I tried to show in this paper, and what I'll try to communicate today, is two things. That Vedic culture wasn't India at least 5,000 years ago, and way before that, even. And I also want to show that archaeology was going on in India before the Europeans came. I mean, even the Indian archaeologists who write about the history of archaeology in India, they say it began when the European travelers arrived. But that's not true. There was a native Indian tradition of archaeology that was going on in parallel to this European-based archaeology that came into India. And one example of that is the excavation of the Sri Nathji deity. From traditional sources, like Bhakti Ratnakara and Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition, this deity was installed by King Vajranaba on Govardhan Hill in Vrindavan 5,000 years ago. A little less than 5,000 years ago. Now, Vajranaba was the great grandson of Krishna, and he was given the Vrindavan area as his realm, his kingship, was there. So he installed many deities of Krishna there. And later, starting in the 11th century AD, there were some raids, invasions, of the Vrindavan area by soldiers, who were attached to the forces of Mahmud of Ghazni. And starting at that time, the deities began to, the pujaris, began to hide, the deities, bury them in some cases. So in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which was completed in the year 1615, we have an account of how Madhavendra Puri in the late 15th century, the late 1400s, excavated this deity. Madhavendra Puri came to Vrindavan in the late 15th century, and he was meditating near Govindakund, and there's a bhajan kutir there that marks the place. And, to make a long story short, Krishna appeared to him in a dream and revealed the location of this deity. Now you have to imagine me in the British Museum in front of a whole audience of archaeologists presenting this exact same presentation. you know the story very well, but for many of them it was quite new. And it's very interesting to be able to do that. But I figured out this angle that they're just not aware of this alternate tradition of archaeology, of digging things up. Krishna in a dream revealed the location of this Gopal deity. Of course, that's the name that we use. And he went to the nearby village of Anior, and gathered together some of the villagers with, you know, shovels and picks and things like that. And they went out to a spot at the base of Govardhan Hill, and they began digging, and they found the deity. So this is a kind of transcendental archaeology. And this shrine marks the place where he found the deity. And then Madhavendra Puri and the villagers installed the deity on the top of Govardhan Hill, and later, you know, a temple was built up there, and this is said to be the, you know, the remains of that temple. But then later, there were some more invasions of the Vrindavan area by forces connected with the Emperor Aurangzeb. And at that time, the Gopal deity was moved to Nathdwar in Rajasthan in the 17th century, you know, where, you know, the deity still resides today. So what's the significance of this account? Now, Dilip Chakravarti, who's a, you know, famous Indian archaeologist, wrote in his book about the history of Indian archaeology about these early European travelers' accounts, "Without doubt, these records constitute the first group of archaeological writings on India." But I think that's not true, because there was a tradition of archaeology going on in India before the European travelers even got there. You know, for example, this account by Krishnadas Kaviraj predates these other accounts, and it describes events that took place in the late part of the 15th century. So there are other examples, more ancient examples of archaeology in India. The Mahabharata gives an interesting account of King Maruta, who lived long ago, millions of years ago. And once he had to perform a sacrifice, and for the sacrifice he needed gold. So a sage told him, "Well, if you go into the Himalayas to a certain mountain, you'll find all the gold that you need." So he went there, and he mined the gold, and he had his artisans turn it into sacrificial implements for his sacrifice, and he performed the sacrifice. Then he distributed some of the gold objects to the brahmanas, but there was just so much gold, so many gold implements, that he buried the rest. So later, much later, about 5,000 years ago, King Yudhisthira had to perform a sacrifice, a big sacrifice, and he needed gold implements for the sacrifice. So Vyasadeva, you know, being Trikalagya, he knew about the gold that had been left in the Himalayas by King Maruta millions of years previously. So he told King Yudhisthira, "Go out to this particular mountain in the Himalayas and excavate, and you'll find it." So King Yudhisthira got an expedition together, and the expedition went out into the Himalayan mountains to the place designated by Vyasadeva, and he began to dig. I mean, not personally himself. He brought a whole retinue, you know, out there. And they began to dig. They began to conduct excavations, and they found these ancient artifacts that had been left by King Maruta millions of years previously. So this is another example of Vedic archaeology. And there are other examples of this Vedic archaeological tradition in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. For example, we learn that Lord Chaitanya came to the Vrindavan area in the early 16th century. And one place he visited was Pavana Sarovara. And this is near Nandigram. And when he was there, he was informed by the villagers that there were deities of Nanda, Yashoda, and Krishna buried in a cave on the hill. So in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says he excavated the cave. That's the exact word used. He excavated the cave, and he found these deities. And then later, he left them there. And later, Sanatana Goswami came and took them, and they were installed in a temple on the hill there. Lord Chaitanya was also looking for Radha Kunda and Shyama Kunda, which are places of Krishna's most intimate pastimes with Radharani. But nobody could tell him where these places were. But by his transcendental vision, he was able to detect that two small ponds in the middle of some rice fields were the actual locations of Radha Kunda and Shyama Kunda. And he later, after having identified them, after Lord Chaitanya had identified these places, then Raghunath Das Goswami excavated them and began to turn them into the pilgrimage places that we know today. So because of this work, this transcendental archaeological work, carried out by Lord Chaitanya and his followers, were able to visit these places today and take spiritual advantage of them. So Lord Chaitanya, he instructed the six Goswamis to continue this transcendental archaeological work. Particularly, Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami. And I'll just give one example of their transcendental archaeological work. Rupa Goswami was searching very intensely for the Govindaji deity. And this deity was another deity that had originally been installed by Vajranabha in Vrindavan. It had become lost, and he was searching everywhere for this deity because Lord Chaitanya had asked him to find all these deities. And once he was just so frustrated that he was sitting on the banks of the Jamuna crying because he couldn't find this deity. And this boy came up to him and said, why are you crying? And he explained why he was crying. He said, come with me. The boy said, come with me, and took him to a hill. And on this hill, there was a cow, pouring down milk on the top of the hill. And then later, at first Rupa Goswami didn't understand what was going on. Later he understood. Actually, it was Krishna showing him the location of the Govindaji deity. So he gathered together some villagers. They went to the top of that hill. They began to conduct an excavation. And they found the Govindaji deity. And then, at first, Rupa Goswami worshipped the deity in a very simple fashion. But later, Man Singh, who was a friendly to Gaudiya Vaishnavas, although he was working in the service of the Mughal emperor, built this temple on the Gomatila hill here in Vrindavan. And if you go downstairs inside the temple, you come to a small chamber where you can see the place where Rupa Goswami excavated this deity. Of course, this was another one of the deities that left Vrindavan during the 17th century, during the time of the invasions of Aurangzeb. So today, Govindaji is in Jaipur, where he can still be seen. The work of the six Goswamis was carried on by one of their contemporaries, Narayan Bhatta, who arrived in Vrindavan from South India in the early 16th century. And he did a lot of transcendental archaeological work. Laid out the pilgrimage route that we generally follow today. He excavated many deities. He located the 12 forests of Vrindavan in the locations that we're now familiar with. And he identified many other forests, not just the 12 main forests. He did a lot of transcendental archaeological work. Once he was wandering around on the Brahma Hill in Vrindavan, and he was in a certain bhav, in a certain mentality, very deeply in trance. And in that state, he encountered, Srimati Radharani appeared to him, according to his biographers, and revealed the location of deities of Radha and Krishna. They were buried somewhere on the hill. And these deities had also originally been installed by Vajranabha. So, following the directions of Radharani, he dug and he found the deities, and those are the deities that are now installed at the temple in Varshana. Now, this kind of thing has gone on all over India, not just in the Vrindavan area. A few years ago, I was on a lecture tour of South India, and I went to Rajamundry, which is on Andhra Pradesh, and during one of my free days, I went with another one of the speakers to visit different places. And one of the places we visited was the Jagan Mohini Keshava Swami Temple in Rialli, Andhra Pradesh. It's the temple there. The temple has a very interesting deity in it that's connected with the Mohini Murti Leela. Of course, we know Krishna took the form of a beautiful woman, the Mohini Murti, in order to bewilder the demons and favor the demigods millions and millions of years ago. And later, Lord Shiva decided he wanted to see that same form. And Krishna said, "I don't think you want to see it. I don't think you'd be able to handle it." And Shiva said, "I can handle it. Let's see." So, because he insisted, Krishna manifested the form, and in this particular leela or pastime, Shiva became attracted by the form and began to chase after it. At a certain place, according to the temple traditions, temple records, a flower fell from the hair of the Mohini Murti, and the place where the flower fell is this place, Rialli. And according to the temple records, a deity self-manifested at that place at that time. And, of course, as in many temples, they don't let you take pictures of the actual deity, but they did give me a little brochure with a very, poor picture of the deity in black and white. But it's actually, it's a very big deity. It's about life size. It's a big piece of black stone, and it said that the form self-manifested. And on the front, if you see the front of the deity, it's a form of, you know, Vishnu or Narayan with all of his symbols. And if you're in the temple, the pujaris take you around to the back of the deity. And in the back, you can see it's the form of the Mohini Murti, her back, you know, with her sari, her hair going, you know, down her back. So this deity shows the Mohini Murti at the moment she's transforming back into Vishnu or Narayan. It's a very interesting deity. The now, according to the temple histories, the temple was the temple and deity that were there millions of years ago were lost and they were buried. Then, a few thousand years ago, one of the Chola kings was going through a forest, you know, the forest in this area, the jungle, and you know, he fell asleep. And when he fell asleep, Krishna appeared to him in a dream and revealed that somewhere nearby this deity was buried. So Krishna instructed him, when you wake up, I want you to get in your chariot and I want you to drive, you know, around in the forest. At a certain place, the wheel of your chariot will fall off because the bolt that's holding it to its axle will break. It'll fall out. And at that place, you dig, and you'll find me. So, you know, the king followed the instruction. The wheel fell off the chariot. He dug at that place, and he found the deity, and built the temple that's presently there. And this is, you know, the Sri Rangam temple in South India. It's located in Tamil Nadu state, way in the south. And it's the temple is built on an island in the Kaveri River. The deity there is a reclining form of Vishnu, you know, Vishnu lying on a serpent bed. This deity, according to the temple chronicle, has a very long and interesting history. It was originally worshipped by Brahma on Brahma Loka. Then it was given to the sun god, Vivasvan, who worshipped it on the sun planet. And from Vivasvan, it went to King Ikshvaku. So King Ikshvaku was a king ruling in Ayodhya. He was a member of the Surya Vamsa, solar dynasty. So many, many millions of years ago, this deity was being worshipped in Ayodhya. And it was worshipped there until the time of Lord Ramachandra. As I was mentioning yesterday, according to Rupa Goswami, in his Laghu Bhagavatamrita, the pastimes of Lord Ram took place in the Treta Yuga of the 24th Yuga cycle of the Vaivasvata Manvantara period, the one we're in now. Of course, we're now in the Kali Yuga of the 28th Yuga cycle. So these Yuga cycles are about 4 million years for a Chatur Yuga. So this deity was being worshipped in Ayodhya almost 20 million years ago at the time of Lord Ram. Then, of course, we know, yeah, the story. I mean, you know, Ram killed the demon Ravana. But after that, Ram took Ravana's brother Vibhishana, who was actually friendly, actually a devotee, back with him to Ayodhya and gave him this deity. Then Vibhishana was taking the deity back to Lanka, and he stopped on this island in the Kaveri River, and the deity wouldn't move any further. So one of the deity wanted to accept service from the local king, so he decided to stay there. And the king built a temple. And this is millions of years ago. And then later, the temple was covered by sand and jungle, floods, things like that, and the deity was lost. So then, 5 or 10,000 years ago, somewhere in that period, a king was going through this forest, went to sleep in the forest. See, this is how, scientists, they try to find things using, remote sensing, satellites. So in this transcendental archaeology, Krishna reveals the location by dreams. it's a kind of a different kind of remote sensing. But the king was sleeping and Krishna appeared in a dream and said, "Nearby, I'm here. You just have to dig, you'll find me." So the king followed the instruction and began to dig. He found the foundations of the old temple and the deity, and so he began to construct a new temple. So, of course, that's very interesting. If over 5,000 years ago, we've got a Vedic temple in South India. That contradicts what the historians are saying now, that Vedic culture only entered India from the northwest 3,500 years ago. So Srila Prabhupada writes a very interesting thing about this temple in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It is said, Srila Prabhupada writes, it is said that in the year 289 of the age of Kali, the Alvar of the name Tondurardipadi was born. He prepared the third boundary wall of the Ranganath temple and cultivated a Tulsi garden there. The Alvars are the saints of South India. The Sri Vaishnavas respect them greatly. One of them was Tondurardipadi, and he was born in year 289 of the age of Kali. So that means almost 5,000 years ago, 4,800 years ago or so. And the Sri Rangam temple surrounded by seven walls. So he erected the third wall, according to Srila Prabhupada, towards the very beginning of the Kali Yuga, almost 5,000 years ago, we could say. And that would mean the second wall had to have been built earlier, and the first wall earlier than that. Once I was on a lecture tour of South India, the same one I was talking about a little bit earlier, and I went to Kanchipuram. And I went to the Sanskrit University there, and I met an archaeologist, Indian archaeologist, and I told him about what Srila Prabhupada had written here. And he said, "Well, we think the Alvars existed around the time of Christ, about 2,000 years ago." And I said, "Well, that's not what the original Tamil sources say." Tamil's the language of South India. And I said, "That's not what the original Tamil sources said. And I think if you check with some of the scholars here, they'll tell you that." So he did. He consulted some of the Tamil scholars. And I said, "Yes, the Alvars go back, much further in time than that, to around 5,000 years ago." So that got him a little bit interested. And I said, "Well, maybe, there's some possibility we could do some archaeological work, at this temple and, see if we can try to show, when that third boundary wall was constructed." So this is the archaeologist. We agreed to go to the Sri Rangam temple, so we went, along with a disciple of mine who's an archaeologist. We just wanted to do some initial looking around to see if it would be possible to do any archaeological work there. This is the third boundary wall, at Sri Rangam, the one that Srila Prabhupada wrote about. And you kind of see here it's all paved and there's pilgrims walking up and down, so it wouldn't be very likely that, you know, the temple authorities would let anybody, you know, start digging holes there or anything like that. But we did see some areas that look like it might be possible to do something, particularly on one side. There was a garden area that's completely walled off, and there's lots of areas, you know, that the public doesn't go, where it should be possible to do some work. Of course, it's not easy to arrange these things. First of all, you have to have the permission of the temple trust. You know, the Sri Rangam temple is controlled by a trust. They were, the officials that we spoke with were a little bit favorable, but you also need to get the permission of the Archaeological Survey of India, and they weren't so favorable, so that's kind of where, you know, things are at the moment with that. But this would be a case where it might be possible to do some research and actually show that the temple is at least 5,000 years old. And it might even be possible to find the old foundations that were there. Because even in the official guidebook of the temple, you know, which is written by a European archaeologist, she says, "The disappearance of the temple beneath the floodwater, sand, and forest has possibly some historical truth. The present temple may have built over earlier foundations, which could now only be discovered by random excavations." So even the official, you know, temple guidebook is saying that there are probably remains of the old temple underneath the ground, and that it should be possible to discover them by, you know, conducting some excavation. So, of course, that's what we'd like to do. Now, another example of transcendental archaeology is the rediscovery of Lord Chaitanya's birthplace. And that work was done by the great transcendental archaeologist Bhaktivinod Thakur. Once Bhaktivinod Thakur and one of his sons were staying at an ashram in Navadvip. And one night they were on the roof of the ashram looking across the Ganges, and Bhaktivinod Thakur saw a brilliant column of light, you know, just coming down from the sky, you know, into a certain area. And the next day, you know, he went there to the place, and, you know, there were some Muslim villagers there, and he saw like a hill, a little hill covered with tulsi trees, and the local villager said, "Well, this was the appearance place of the Hindu saint, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu." You know, so with that first bit of information, you know, Bhaktivinod Thakur began doing more research. One thing that has to be considered. Lord Chaitanya, according to the Bhakti Ratnakara, appeared in Mayapur, which was described as a part of the town of Navadvip. If you look at old maps, there are different names for Navadvip. You know, sometimes Nadia, Nudia, Nadia, you know, those are the names historically that have been used for the place. So the problem was that today, you know, Mayapur, the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya, is on, you know, the east side of the river, and the town of Navadvip is on the west side. So that creates a little bit of a problem, but Bhaktivinod Thakur began to consult old historical records, old maps. Unfortunately, his original notes on the work that he did aren't available, but there's enough, you know, information to suggest what actually happened. Like, there are old maps of the area from the 17th century, this Dutch map, for example, that that shows Nadia or Navadvip on the east bank of the Ganges at that time. But then by the 18th century, see, Nadia here is, or Navadvip, Nadia is number 14. So now you see 14 is on the west bank of the river. So this, I mean, the Ganges has been constantly, you know, shifting its banks, and settlements have moved. So over the course of time, although Navadvip was originally on the east side of the river, today the city with that name is now on the west. But to confirm that the place he found was the actual birthplace of Lord Chaitanya, Bhaktivinoda Thakur brought the great Gaudiya Vaishnava saint Jagannath Das Babaji to the place, kind of serve as an instrument, like the archaeologists, when they find something, they want to test it, they bring their scientific instruments to tell them if they've got the date right or wrong. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur brought this transcendental instrument, this great personality, Jagannath Das Babaji, to the place. And he was quite old at the time, you know, according to his biographers, you know, 120 years old, something like that, not able to walk very well, so he was carried to the place in a basket. And when he was brought to the place, you know, he began, you know, to just, he jumped out and was chanting loudly that this was the place of Lord Chaitanya's birth. So that confirmed it. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur created a society, a sabha, to build a small temple at the place, which, you know, he did. And then later his son, Bhaktisananta Saraswati Thakur, built a larger temple at the place, which is the one, you know, we see there today at the Yoga Pit, Lord Chaitanya's birthplace in Mayapur. Now when they were excavating the foundation for this temple, they found this Adhokshaja Vishnu deity. And according to some of the old sources, Lord Chaitanya's father, Jagannath Mishra, worshipped an Adhokshaja Vishnu deity. So the discovery of this deity was taken as additional confirmation that this was indeed the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. Now once, Bhaktisananta Saraswati Thakur was taking some of his disciples on a pilgrimage through Mayapur, and they were going from the Bhajan Kutir of Bhaktivinoda Thakur to Nisringapalli. And there's a lake here, and, you know, according to Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, this is a place where Lord Nisringadev came to wash off his claws, you know, after having dispatched, you know, killed, you know, the demon Hiranyakashipu. And again, according to Rupa Goswami's Laga Bhagavatamrita, the pastimes of Lord Nisringadev, Prahlad Maharaj, took place in the Chakshusha Manvantara period. So we're now about 120 million years through the Vaivasvata Manvantara period. So that means those pastimes took place over 100 million years ago, if we accept what Rupa Goswami says. But at the time that these pastimes took place, you know, a deity of Lord Nisringadev was manifest at this place, and it's still there in a temple today. But on the way to Nisringapalli, Bhaktisananta Saraswati and his disciples passed by this place, and Bhaktisananta Saraswati said, "I want this land." And the owner of the land came out and said, "Oh, Maharaj, this is not very good land. It's just jungle full of jackals and tigers. If you want some land, I can give you some very nice land. You know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, no, I want this land. So the owner gave it to him. Later, he sent his disciples out to explore the land, and they found some remains of an old palace. And the disciples inquired what it was, and he told them, these are the remains of the palace of King Suvarna, who lived here during the Satya Yuga, about 4 million years ago. And this king, Suvarna, he heard from Narada Muni that Lord Chaitanya would later appear in Navadvipa. So he was very upset that, you know, here it was, the Satya Yuga, it would be millions of years, you know, before Lord Chaitanya would appear. So he was very unhappy, he was crying. he didn't take birth in Navadvipa at a time when Lord Chaitanya would be there. So later, Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda appeared to him in a dream and said, don't worry. Lord Chaitanya said, when I come, you will be one of my associates. So he, later in the Kali Yuga, you know, this King Suvarna took birth as Buddhimanta Khan, who was one of the associates of Lord Chaitanya, you know, arranged one of his weddings to one of his wives. So if you go to this place today, there's a small Gaudiya Math temple there. It's part of the Parikrama. Many of you have probably been there. The Pujaris will show you pieces of the old Satya Yuga temple. I kind of asked them where they found them, and they said, well, we found them in this pit here, in this mango grove. So, you know, it may be possible to do some more transcendental archaeological work there, find more of the remains of this Satya Yuga temple. Now, you know, when we talk about Indian archaeology, there's some questions that, you know, come up about different places. One of them is, well, what about Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro? So these are ancient cities in the northwest, in what's now Pakistan. Used to be part of India, but Harappa is here. They're in the Indus Valley. Mohenjo-Daro's down here, Harappa's here, and there are many other cities that are considered to be part of what's called the Harappan civilization, which existed 5,000 years ago. And the question for archaeologists is, well, what was the culture in this city? Now, those who favor the Aryan migration idea would say they weren't Vedic people. They were some other culture that existed 5,000 years ago in India. And then 3,500 years ago, the Sanskrit-speaking Vedic people invaded and moved in or migrated and took over, you know, that region. But they would say that, you know, these Harappan cities, including Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, were not Vedic. Now, there are others who would say, well, they should be Vedic, because the Vedic culture is native to India. It was present 5,000 years ago there. Excuse me. So as I said, there are others who will want to say that they were Vedic cities. There should be signs of Vedic culture there. So what do we say? Well, I think we always have to refer to Shastra, you know, to get our idea of what we should expect to find. So in the 12th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's some predictions about the age of Kali. And it says, the land along the Sindhu River, which is the Sanskrit name for the Indus, the land along the Sindhu River, as well as the districts of Chandrabhaga County and Kashmira, will be ruled by Sudras, fallen Brahmanas, and meat-eaters. Having given up the path of Vedic civilization, they will have lost all spiritual strength. So I think this would lead us to expect that there might be some signs of Vedic culture there, but it's not going to be the pure Vedic culture. It's going to be a distorted form or an incomplete form of the Vedic culture. Because according to Srimad Bhagavatam, that area, the Indus area, was ruled by these people who were fallen from the Vedic culture. So I think that's what we should expect to find there. Some signs of Vedic culture, but not the pure Vedic culture. Now, I'll go over some of the things that show that some type of Vedic culture was there. This is a model, like a toy or model, of an ox cart, you know, that was found at Harappa. And here's a modern Indian ox cart. Exactly the same. I think that shows some connection. Then, this is a statue of a priest that was found there. And someone pointed out to me that the his chadar is worn the exact same way that Vedic pujaris wear their chadars, and he has a beard like many of them do today, and actually a flower pattern on his chadar. And actually, I saw somebody like that in the temple this morning, with a flower chadar and a beard, looking just like this guy. At Harappa, a bathing tank was uncovered near a building that appears to be a temple. And there were little bathing huts, like what you would expect to find if you had a place where pujaris, were taking their bath, before, they would worship at the temple. They would have a little place, to change clothes or something and take their bath, go back, dress, go into the temple. And these bathing tanks are a feature of Vedic culture everywhere. Like this is one in Jagannath Puri. And then this interesting figure of some type of deity in a yoga posture, was found, at Harappa. And objects that resemble Shiva lingas, were found there. Actually, my disciple, who's an archaeologist, was visiting the Archaeology Museum in New Delhi, and she was looking at some of these Shivalinga-type objects that had been found at Harappa. And a class of Indian school children was being taken through the museum by their teachers and the museum guides. And the children were saying, "Oh, look, Shivalingas, Shivalingas." And their teachers were saying, no, they're not, because there was no Vedic culture then. But any Indian person who looks at them, any Hindu person who looks at them, understands they were Shivalingas. And there were many images of bulls also, of course. Bull is sacred to Shiva. And then these little tablets or seals, they have some kind of inscription on them. And many of these have been found, and many of them have these letters on. And this language has never been deciphered. Many people have tried to decipher it, and every one of them thinks they have done it, but you know, maybe there's about 40 or 50 different attempts to decipher. And basically the decipherments fall into two categories. Some of them, those who don't think Vedic culture was present, will try to decipher the language as being something other than Sanskrit or Sanskrit-based. And those who favor the idea that Vedic culture was present will try to translate it as something related to Sanskrit. And there may be some grounds for that. If you look at the symbols, you'll see there, these are a few of them. There are actually about 400 or so different symbols. So it's too many letters for an alphabetic language. You know, like an alphabet, like English, we have 30 letters about. But it's too few letters to be like a hieroglyphic language, because in a hieroglyphic language you need a different symbol for each word. You know, like Chinese, they've got thousands, you know, of ideographs. Or the Egyptian language, they have thousands of hieroglyphs. So it's too many for an alphabetic language, too few for a hieroglyphic language. But if we look at Sanskrit, like if you look at all the different combinations of letters, if you include not just the basic letters, but all the combination of syllables, like this one, you add them up, there's, you know, about 400 really. And we see that a lot of, you know, the Sanskrit letters, it's like the same letter, but it just has a different mark on it. You know, like here's this, and this has this on it. Or this T, you know, it's got this vowel symbol on it. So if you go back to, excuse me, this Harappan thing, you can see that there's, they've got like a lot of the same symbols, but just different markings on them. Yeah, just like in Sanskrit, you've got a basic letter, and then you have all these vowel signs or combinations of consonants. So, as I said, nobody's really figured out this script yet, but it has features that are really suggestive of something like the Sanskrit alphabet, with its combinations of consonants and vowel marks. Now, one question that comes up a lot is, what about Rama's bridge? This has to do with a NASA satellite photo. This is South India here. This is Sri Lanka. And then there's this feature here, which appears... what it actually is, it's sandbars and things like that that are just under the surface of the water. And some people say, well, this is Rama's bridge. You know, the bridge that Lord Ram made to go to Lanka. Some remains of that. I would like that to be true, but especially when you're dealing with people who are going to ask hard questions, sometimes you have to have some more solid proof than something like this. And I think there are two things that have to be considered. You know, one is, I think maybe there needs to be more geological work done there, and some more Shastric research. Say if it is Rama's bridge, then we should expect to find some big stones that really don't belong there. Like if somebody were to start digging into those sandbars, you know, you would expect to find some big stones that don't normally belong in that place. And actually, according to some sources, they should have Ram's name written on them too. that's also there. So I think it would be helpful, you know, if, you know, we get some devotee geologist or somebody to do that kind of research. Like, another problem is, you know, more from the Shastric angle, is the Surya Siddhanta says that Lanka is on the same meridian or line of longitude as what's the city there? Ujjain. Yeah, Ujjain. So that line of longitude goes down like this, and you can see Sri Lanka is over here somewhere. And another Shastric problem is that the Ramayana itself says that when Hanuman leaped from South India to Lanka, he crossed 100 yojanas of ocean, which means about 800 miles. So, you know, taking those things to account, if Lanka is on the line, the same line that goes down through Ujjain, and it's about 800 miles from the coast of South India, should be down here somewhere. You know, not over here. So there's so it's an interesting case, you know, the case of Rama's bridge. But I think it needs a little more research, both from the Shastric angle and, you know, from the geological angle, before we can really start saying it's proof of, you know, the historical events in the Ramayana. Another question that comes up a lot is, what about, you know, Dwarka? There's Dwarka. There's a city of that name now on the coast of Gujarat. And there have been some, of course, there's a beautiful temple, Dwarkadish there. But there's been some work done by marine archaeologists, Indian marine archaeologists, Dr. Rao, for example. And they found remains of city, you know, off the coast. You can see some walls there and other structures. So the question is, well, is that Krishna's Dwarka? So there's a couple of problems with the current discovery. This Dr. Rao dated the remains as being from 3,500 years ago, about 1,500 years B.C. From our Shastric sources, we would expect that Krishna's Dwarka should be about 5,000 years old, from about 3,000 B.C. So, there are a couple of possibilities. One possibility is Dr. Rao got the date wrong, and that if some devotee archaeologists were to do new dating studies, they might find that the remains are 5,000 years old, which would show, well, it's a good chance it is some remains of Krishna's Dwarka. Because in his books, Srila Prabhupada says that sometimes, you know, people see remains of Dwarka off the coast in the waters there. So, could be some remains from Krishna's city. But another possibility is, if there are any remains of Krishna's city, they might be at a deeper level. Because the idea is that if the sea levels have been rising, you know, for the past few thousand years. So we have today's Dwarka here, but 1,500 years ago, the sea level would have been here, and maybe that's what Dr. Rao found. And if there are remains of Dwarka, they could be further out at some deeper level. Now, in one sense, we're all transcendental archaeologists, because Krishna is buried deep in our hearts under layers of material contamination. So somehow or other, that's our task as devotees, is we have to uncover Krishna. Yeah, within our, we have to excavate Krishna. And Lord Chaitanya has given us a very powerful method to do that. you know, the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, thank you for listening to this. Report on excavating the eternal. Yes, Prabhu. No, I don't, but it should be. Usually, I think Tirupati has a temple chronicle. Many times, the local, you know, the pundit or the one that you talk to doesn't know the story. But I believe the Tirupati temple has a temple chronicle that gives the history, you know, of the temple. I've been there, and they gave me a small English, I think, translation of it. And there's a whole complicated history to the temple, why it's there.
Because the body is very, very old, the whole body.
Yeah. There's a very complicated history to the temple and why it's there. And I can't remember it all, you know, from my mind. But what I have found is that it's possible to get... Now, you may have to find somebody to read Tamil for you if you don't. But most of the temples have temple chronicles. Like the Jagannath Temple has a temple chronicle. The Sri Rangam Temple has one. I'm sure the Tirupati one does too. You just have to get the manuscript and then have someone read it. I mean, one of my plans is to travel all over India and document the existence of many of these. But there's so many places, but Tirupati would be a good place to start. Do you know anything there, Maharaj? Yeah. Anybody know? Any people from Tamil Nadu here? Yeah?
Okay. No, Maharaj, I have some specific...
Or Agra.
I have
a
friend called Agra.
So, yeah, it's true. They're from satellites. They can see a channel. They call it today the Gagar, or the channel. But it appears to be the Sarasvati that's spoken about in the Rig Veda. It's also mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Actually, there are two Sarasvatis. There's a lot of Sarasvati rivers all over India. But this particular one goes down this way. And there is a dry channel there, and it's lined with settlements that were there. And even in, there's one devotee who wrote a master's thesis about these rivers. And there are actually some statements in the Mahabharata somewhere, I can't remember exactly where they are, about how the rivers will be drying up and things like that. So the Rig Veda describes this river Sarasvati with big cities on it. And it appears to be this dry river channel that was discovered by satellite, you know, photos. So that would mean that the Rig Veda is... And that river hasn't been flowing for about 5,000 years. So that would mean that the Rig Veda was written in India over 5,000 years ago, because it's talking about a river that was only existing 5,000 years ago. It can't be written 3,500 years ago, because 3,500 years ago nobody knew the river was there. You know, it was gone, you know, by then. So the fact that there is evidence that there was this mighty river that is in the same location as the Sarasvati described in the Rig Veda, I mean, that's evidence that the Rig Veda was written at least 5,000 years ago in India. Yes, so you're right about that. So she's a disciple of Hridayananda Maharaj. But if you have my email address, if you write to me later and ask me about it, I forgot her name right now, but I'll tell you her name. Yes?
Could you maybe elaborate, what are the needs like of the modern archaeologists? For example, try to find out how all this world runs, how they can estimate this kind of things.
How they can estimate?
Yeah. What are, I mean, has there been done any kind of effort to try to estimate by them, for example, the run?
Well, no, because I mean, they estimate, you know, that, you know, the temple is maybe 1,000 years old or something like that. It's there's many archaeologists in India, including those in the positions of authority, accept this Aryan migration idea. And therefore, it's very difficult to get approval. You know, like, you know, if you try to show, well, yeah, the temple is 5,000 years old, that means you're trying to prove something in the Hindu scriptures. Hence, you are a Hindu fundamentalist, you know, trying to cause strife, you know, between the different communities in India. And nobody wants that. Now, when I was on that tour in South India, you know, some reporters, they asked me, you know, about that particular issue. And I said, well, the truth won't hurt anybody. The actual truth will not hurt anybody. I said, it is a fact, however, that some people will try to use the truth to hurt other people. And I don't go along with that. I don't support that. But the truth itself is not going to hurt anybody. Yes. That's another answer. So it depends on... Now, you know, sometimes you can run into an archaeologist who is favorable to the idea that the Vedic culture has been present at least 5,000 years. And then, and also I think we need, and we do have members of our movement who are seriously studying archaeology now, who are getting PhDs in archaeology, studying Hindi and Sanskrit and things like that, and who are doing work in India and Pakistan, and if they develop the right skills and they come in contact with the right archaeologists in India, because you have to be very diplomatic, because you'll see some are favorable to this idea of the Vedic culture was there in ancient times and some aren't. But if you find the right one, and just like I found this one, you know, archaeologist in South India who was a little bit favorable, and was willing to go through the exercise of getting permissions. But he ran into a problem with the archaeological survey. So one has to understand how the politics of this goes in the archaeological survey. And find, yeah, like that, you know, like... So they have not been so inclined up to this time themselves. Now, under the previous government, there were some attempts, I think, to try to investigate these things. But it has to be done very carefully. I think it's possible. Yeah, I'm trying to do some of these things. There are others who are kind of younger devotees who want to do things like this and who are trying to prepare themselves, you know, to do these things. I think eventually it will be done. But as I mentioned the first day, for ourselves, we don't need, you know, scientific dating methods. For us, Shastra, our Guru Shastra and Sadhu are enough, you know, to show that Vedic culture was present 5,000 years ago and more. That's all we need. Now, because not everybody accepts those sources of knowledge, then, you know, sometimes we have to engage in, you know, this business of trying to date things. You know, like, to try to move people in towards accepting Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu as the ultimate sources of knowledge. Okay, yes, Maharaj?
Hello,
yes.
How was he going to date them?
Well, from... It all depends. Like, yeah, from the stone itself, you can't really say anything. Now, if it's some kind of baked brick, you know, then there's a method called thermoluminescence that will allow you to get some idea of how old a brick is.
Can you go into more
detail on thermoluminescence? It's not a method that I know a lot about in terms of the details. I mean, carbon, you know, because it's not used very often in the kind of work that I've been doing. But it's based on the idea that heat kind of like sets, you know, like energy, yeah, like, yeah, there's a certain amount of energy in the clay crystals and things like that, and then by, you know, when it's subjected to heat, and then, yeah, it, and then, you know, by subjecting the by heating the sample and seeing how much light, what wavelengths of light, you know, come out of it, they get some idea of, you know, when the heat was applied, you know, to the mineral crystals and the clay. It's I haven't really studied it very deeply because up to this point it hasn't been very useful for any of the things I've been doing up to this point. But it could be useful in, like, in India. Other methods are, like, say if you have a stone structure and there's a mortar, you know, between the stones, then the mortar contains organic substances that can be dated using the carbon-14 method. So that's one method. And if in the excavations they find organic substances, pieces of charcoal, things like that, those can be dated using the carbon-14 method. Sometimes they could also find, if it, we're not talking about things that are very old, you know, if they find coins of a certain age or a king, a name of a certain king inscribed. Yeah, cultural artifacts. Mm. Yeah, that's how they established the dating methods.
Generating a curve.
Yes.
But then the actual 2,000 years ago was...
Well, they've used objects that were found in Egyptian tombs that go back about 6,000 years to kind of like... And then they also try to do it with tree rings. You know, like fossil trees and things like that, you know, to kind of calibrate their method. It's not perfect, but I think it's based on a sound scientific principle, but could be wrong. Like, one thing I've noticed is that, and I was talking about this yesterday, is that if you're a young Earth Christian creationist who believes the whole Earth is 10,000 years old or less, then you're going to have big problems with all the dating methods. Because the ages that these methods give are kind of consistent with the Vedic time scales, we don't have as big a problem as a young earth Christian creationist would. But as I said, our main method for dating things is Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. You know, that's how we date things. And these other methods, they're there. And we sometimes discuss them in connection with people who don't accept Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu as authorities. Yes? Well, by...
The Aryans.
From Central Asia or Europe, there are many different theories where, you know, the original homeland was for the people who accept that it wasn't India. You know, some people... Yes. Yes. Yeah, well, they have... Well, I think the main reason they had it is because around the time of Sir William Jones, who I mentioned earlier, they started noticing similarities between European languages and Sanskrit. So they didn't want to accept that the European languages came from Sanskrit, because that would imply, you know, that, you know, the Indian culture was the root of the European cultures. So they decided, yeah. So then what they did is they decided there must have been some other language that was before Sanskrit, before all the European languages, that they all came from. So that language they call Proto-Indo-European. And nobody has ever found any written words in this language. There's no text for it, no inscriptions. They've simply invented it by certain rules of linguistics that they have. That, you know, for example, like in Portuguese, they say praza. In Spanish, they say plaza. In Portuguese, they say praza. So they say that means, okay, L goes to R. So that means if you have an R, then before that it was an L once. Yeah. So using laws like that, you know, they think, okay, there must have been some language where the R was a K or something, and they construct this whole artificial language.
And also from Sanskrit, mano can mean wish.
Yeah. Yeah. But they want to say there was something before Sanskrit and all the European languages. They call it Proto-Indo-European. So then, once they've constructed this imaginary language, they have to think, well, where did the people live who spoke this imaginary language? It couldn't be in India, obviously, according to their way of thinking. So practically every different scholar has come up with a different location. Sort of now the one that's favored is kind of like southern Russia, Ukraine area, south of the Ural Mountains, like that. But some have proposed Germany, Turkey, you know, southern Europe, Central Asia. Now they tend to say something like the area in the southern Ukraine. They tend to say like that, many of them now. And then they proposed they migrated down into India and kind of pushed the non-Aryan people who were there, you know, like to the south. And, you know, they constructed this whole history. So, yeah, that's the alternative idea. And... you know, I think it's work that devotee scholars, we need people who are trained in linguistics, archaeology, and things like that to challenge these ideas. Yes, there is an alternative theory, namely that Vedic culture has always been present in India. And there are Indian scholars and even some Western scholars, who are mentioning Dr. Klostermeyer, who believe that. But the dominant idea now in the scientific academic circles is that there was this, and even in India, you know, the dominant idea is that there was this Aryan migration, they call it now.
You mentioned that.
But it's based on speculation. But I think even today we see that, you know, in India, you know, the Vedic texts are written in different scripts. Devanagari, Tamil, Gujarati, Marathi, you know, like, so Vedic knowledge could have been written in another script in the past. Yes? What is that? I didn't catch the last thing you said.
The attack of
Vimana,
they distributed this.
The attack of? Oh, okay, Vamana.
And some other texts, they distributed this to identify the real citizens of the city.
No, but I learn something new every day. You know, if you want to send me the information, that would. Yeah, if you find the source, send it to me. I'd like to have it. I'm the last day, the day after tomorrow, I'm speaking on a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory. So that will be tomorrow. I'm talking about cosmology, and then the last day will be this what I call human devolution, a Vedic alternative to Darwin's theory, where I'll be talking again about some of the defects of that theory and what we might propose in its place. Is there anything else? Yes? Well, yes, Srila Prabhupada mentioned some connection, so I think it has to be taken seriously. I was just in Brazil a couple of months ago, and Srila Prabhupada said, I mean, there's a lot of gold in Brazil, and he said that they were taking gold from Brazil through a tunnel to Lanka. Ravana's brother, I think especially, he mentioned. What was his brother's name?
Prabhupada said that in the morning world to me and to some devotees in Karachi.
Yeah. What was the name of that?
Adi.
Yeah. So, yes, so there's some connection there, and have to see if we can find the tunnel or the gold.
But is there to go there to find the gold?
I've heard different devotees have gone. You know, I won't mention any names, but yeah, I've heard some devotees have gone to South America looking for the tunnels. So, but yeah, I think if Srila Prabhupada said it, we have to take it a little bit seriously, yeah. Something else?
So tomorrow is cosmology.
Yes. Okay. All right, so I think we can stop here. Thank you. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.